have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Let's dive in, and starting with National and British Petroleum.
Yeah, the EPA announced this week that they had banning British Petroleum, BP, from holding U.S. government contracts. BP recently pled guilty in a criminal lawsuit over the Deepwater Horizon oil well blowout in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010. BP will be paying about $4.5 billion in penalty and fines to the U.S. government. Of course, we talked at the time about how that would make a fairly small impact on the company's bottom line. The EPA move, however, will add an additional issues for BP, particularly in the U.S., because they have about $1.5 billion per year in federal contracts. Mostly that's for selling fuel to the Defense Department, particularly for the U.S. deployments overseas. Now, the decision to ban BP from holding U.S. government contracts is only temporary, while the U.S. government oversees BP's operations and oversees court agreement in the lawsuit that BP has to make some changes to the way it does business. Now, BP has, this $1.5 billion in annual government contracts is not all of BP's business in the U.S., of course. Now, BP does a lot of exploration and production of oil in the U.S., particularly in the Gulf of Mexico. They kind of led the way in deep water drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. And the U.S. represents about one-fifth of BP's total global oil and gas production and about one-quarter of the profit from its exploration and production unit. And that doesn't count all of the fuel that it sells to the public in the U.S. So it's really that $1.5 billion U.S. government contracts is about the most the U.S. government can do in terms of buying BP's products. That's its impact on BP's bottom line. But the U.S. could go further by extending its ban on BP's drilling in the Gulf. That would really impact it a lot. As I said, about a fifth of its exploration and production is done in the U.S. So if they did that drilling ban. But of course, that drilling ban was lifted fairly soon after the Deepwater Horizon disaster, as we know. And it's not likely to be reimposed.
Yeah, because the Gulf of Mexico is doing so well that nobody really realized that it was, you know, a serious problem.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's completely recovered.
Seems like I got something in my throat.
No. People remember, too, that during the last hurricane in the Gulf, I think it was Hurricane Irene, is that the name?
Irene was East Coast.
There was a hurricane, I can't remember the name of it, this past year in the Gulf that stirred up a whole bunch of oil from the Deepwater Horizon disaster and deposited it on beaches.
Yeah. It's called Hurricane Mike.
Yeah. All right. Well, tangential to oil and our energy.
Oh, it's not tangential at all.
All right. Susan Rice.
Yeah. Well, it was a massive scandal rocking Washington, D.C., having to do with oil and Susan Rice. And, of course, we are not referring to the nothing burger that is the Republican obsession with Benghazi in oil-rich Libya. And we're not really referring, actually, to rocking Washington, D.C. or raising any kind of attention at all. But it turns out this week that Susan Rice's prospective nomination to an appointment to become the new Secretary of State in the second Obama administration, replacing Hillary Clinton, there's apparently a problem with it, because one of the first major decisions that the Secretary of State is going to face in the new calendar year under the second term is whether to approve or disapprove construction of the XL pipeline, the $7+ billion pipeline that is going to take very, very, very dirty tar sands from northern Alberta all the way through the central states and the Ogallala Aquifer and Great Plains down through Texas and into the oil ports on the Gulf of Mexico. That final decision rests with the Secretary of State because it's a foreign company, TransCanada, that is building the pipeline, because it's Canadian oil, of course, and because that oil actually isn't going to U.S. energy needs. It's simply going to be shipped across the U.S. and then shipped out of the ports in the Gulf of Mexico to other foreign and probably East Asian markets. Well, it turns out that Susan Rice, as a prospective decision maker into whether to build that extremely controversial pipeline, holds somewhere between $300,000 and $600,000 worth of TransCanada stock. And she has more than a dozen other Canadian oil companies and banks stock. Those companies all would benefit from expansion of the North American tar sands industry and construction of the XL pipeline. She could very well be the person who makes the decision on whether that thing gets built or not.
Clear conflict of interest.
Well, fortunately, there's no record existing of a powerful D.C. politician that has extensive holdings in the oil industry and playing favorites on that basis. just ask this Dick Cheney, for starters.
That's the whole last administration, yeah.
So that one could stand to get a little bit more publicity, especially in the environmental movement, where there's been a lot of opposition to the XL. And, you really don't want the final decision of that resting with somebody who has a direct financial interest in getting that thing built.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting that because Obama supports her and she's a Democrat, that the Democrats and the Liberals are out supporting her in force, when in fact they should be looking closer at her record and at her investments in particular.
All right. Moving along, the House Republicans doing a little fighting.
Yeah, it's interesting. This week, a senior House Republican basically stood up and said, hey, guys, it's time to grow up and we need to start negotiating with the Democrats instead of acting like two-year-olds. Senior House Republican Representative Tom Cole of Oklahoma urged Republicans in Congress to compromise with the Democrats over negotiations on the debt and budget and tax increases.
The gentle fiscal incline.
Yeah, and I've got a quote from him. He basically said, and he said this inside of a House Republican meeting, so it wasn't in a public venue. He said, quote, I don't believe in holding the American people hostage to this debate. Let's get what we can now and then go back and try to get the rest. Where there is common ground with the president, we should seize that common ground. And, of course, that makes good common sense. But if you have a leadership like John Boehner, who Job and I were just talking before the show, and pretty much agreed that he can't do his job. Essentially, he has proved he can't do his job. He can't take a position that would be for the good of the people, that not just the people that he represents, but for the American people, and say, okay, yes, let's do what Cole suggests and find the common ground and agree on that and then hammer out the stuff we can agree on later. He can't do that. He can't hold the line. He keeps caving in to Job says his backbenchers, the Tea Party members who don't want to negotiate. But I think also there's a handful of very big donors that he's being really responsive to, the people like the Koch brothers, who say, you know, we don't want you to negotiate with Obama no matter what, because if we have to pay a couple more percentage points in taxes, it's going to kill us. Well, no, the truth is that a couple more percentage points in taxes for extremely wealthy Americans is not going to kill them. It's going to support the social contract. And these folks are acting in their own narrow short-term interests by putting pressure on Boehner.
It doesn't just support the social contract, but these are the people who are the biggest users of government services and the biggest beneficiaries of government services.
They are.
As well.
And they don't care about that. What they care about is how much they're going to have to pay the government in the next couple years. They don't want to have to pay more money to the government because, you know, amassing more and more and more and more wealth gives them, I guess, a nice glow, a nice happy feeling in the morning.
They go to a lot of ports of call and they need a yacht in every one.
Yeah, and I just don't believe that the rest of America should have to suffer because of that.
By the way, going back to Cole's statement, how you can tell that he is, even though it's, somewhat somewhere in the same universe as common sense, but he's still a Republican. And the way you can tell that is he believes this to be true. You know, other people, they rely on facts and science and stuff. But Republicans, they believe things.
They believe things regardless of the evidence.
Yes.
And it's that belief that's important.
Yes.
All right. Anything else about the Republicans? General?
No, let's
All
move
right.
on.
All right. Let's.
Although Job has more to tell you.
Well, down in Florida, the voter ID laws. There.
Yeah. Charlie Crist, the former GOP governor who basically got Tea Partied out of the party and wound up running for running for the Senate as an independent, I believe, and Florida GOP state chair also admitted in an interview to the Palm Beach Post this week that the controversial voter ID laws in Florida that were supposedly meant to combat voter fraud, that was a marketing campaign. And they said this very explicitly, that that was something for public consumption, but the motivating factor behind it all along was to disenfranchise as many Democratic voters as possible. Now, both Crist and the former chair are on the outs with the state leadership in Florida right now of the Republican Party, all of which scrambled to denounce these two traitorous people. But this is something that common sense and an awful lot of critics concluded a long time ago, not just in Florida, but also in Ohio and Wisconsin and Indiana and Pennsylvania and Virginia and North Carolina.
All those
and
swing states.
And a few, well, not just swing states, but all states that are controlled both by a Republican legislature and a Republican governor, and it's just a wild, crazy coincidence, Alec, that these types of laws sprung up in all of these states at about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
There actually was quite a bit of voter suppression, both in voter registration and then in accessibility of the ballot box and long lines and such in the election this year. It wound up not making a difference in the presidential election. It might well have made a difference in a handful of congressional races. The real way in which Republican chicanery is going to make a difference is that Republicans also control the redistricting process for the House of Representatives in a number of states from the 2010 census. And so for the next several years, through the rest of the decade, you're very likely to have a Republican majority in the House that's going to be very difficult to overcome. In fact, in 2012, last month, the Democrats got more overall votes for the House of Representatives than the Republicans did. But it's specifically because of gerrymandering, because the Democrats got larger majorities in the districts that they won than the Republicans did in the districts that they won, which is how gerrymandering works. Mm-hmm. You can have one 9-1 district for your opposition, and then you can win a bunch of 6-4 districts for yourself, and you wind up with a lot more districts, even if it comes out equal. We're going to have those districts for the next 8 years, 10 years actually. And so it's going to be very, very difficult to overcome the kind of recalcitrance that we're seeing. We're talking about Cole and Boehner in the House of Representatives right now because of that gerrymandering. But at least it's good to see that for those kind of efforts and voter suppression efforts and voter disenfranchisement efforts, that the word is starting to come out now that, yes, the public smokescreen about trying to combat vote fraud is just that. It's a smokescreen. It's not a serious problem, and it's not the real motivation behind these laws.
All right. On to future protesting strategies.
Yeah, Hancock Air Force Base in upstate New York is where a number of the drones for the drone warfare in Asia are being controlled from, and there have been a number of nonviolent protests there over recent months by peace protesters that are trying to draw attention to this in that part of the country. And 17 were arrested this past month for blocking three gates at Hancock Air Force Base, and now a local federal judge there has come up with a novel new way of preventing protests that is very likely, I think, probably to spread if the federal government gets wind of this and tries to apply it to other facilities like Osage Bangor. Which is a very similar situation where you have often religiously motivated, nonviolent, ritualized civil disobediences that are trying to draw attention to what is done on that base. In this case, the judge has effectively issued a restraining order, actually a protection order, at the request of base commander Colonel Earl Evans, that he needs personal protection due to his, quote, fear for personal safety from these nonviolent protesters. Thus, protesters are banned at risk of felony charge with 7 years in prison of
This is a military guy, right?
Yeah, this is a military guy.
Trained to kill.
Yes. That due to fears of his for his personal safety, this heavily armed guy who's overseeing the slaughter of civilians in other parts of the world that he has never personally encountered, that protesters are banned from approaching to Evan's home, school, or workplace. His workplace, of course, being the entire base. Even though none of the protesters have ever seen him, know what he looks like, or have a clue where he lives or goes to school, or either goes to school or teaches at a school. Because of that, they can't get anywhere near the base. They've asked local law enforcement personnel, well, if we're not allowed to approach the base, what does that mean? Does that mean that we can stand 3 feet from the border? Does it mean we have to stay 100 yards away? Does it mean we have to stay a half mile away? What does it mean? And basically what they were told, and the key word here is a direct quote, was that they are in violation of that protection order if Colonel Evans is, quote, irritated by one of their protests. So if one guy who has never encountered any of these people and who has, as near as anybody can tell, no reason whatsoever to fear for his personal safety, both because he's heavily armed and because they aren't, is irritated for whatever reason, somebody can go to jail for 7 years. That is a very powerful weapon with which to suppress protests. And that can be used for any particular property or facility. It can be used for a military base. It can also be used for a federal building. It can also be used for a courthouse. It can be used for a park. It can be used for just about anything.
Be challenged in court.
Yeah, and I suspect it will be. But unless it is, and unless that challenge is upheld, that's the kind of a precedent that could be very worrisome in the future.
Vote this week in the Senate.
Yeah, the Senate, for the first time for either, House of Congress, this week, passed a measure to end the Afghanistan war, and they did so rather comfortably. They beat the usual 60 votes that's required to proceed over a Republican filibuster. Jeff Merkley, the senator from Oregon, had an amendment that passed 62-33 that accelerates the Obama administration's planned 2013 drawdowns in Afghanistan. Of course, the Obama administration has placed a deadline after which it will no longer have combat troops in Afghanistan. General Allen, however, and the Pentagon, Allen being the commander of the forces in Afghanistan right now, the Pentagon, and House Republicans want to keep at least 60,000 troops through the end of 2013 without doing any drawdowns whatsoever. Obama wants to do slow, gradual drawdowns, and what the Senate amendment would do would be to accelerate that process. Now, that is not going to actually stick, number one, because it won't be in final legislation, because the House has had virtually an opposite bill, basically wouldn't allow any drawdowns. But it is, for the first time, as I said, the measure of the sense of a House of Congress that over 60% of the people in that House, and in this case the Senate, which tends to move more slowly on these things, is in favor of getting us out of Afghanistan. And that is a measure that should have happened probably about 10 years ago, but it's nice to see it happen now.
And I think it more closely reflects how the American people feel about our involvement in Afghanistan, too.
All right. Moving on to a historic vote this week in the UN.
Yeah. Go ahead.
If you want. The UN General Assembly this week granted Palestine non-member observer status on Thursday on the 65th anniversary of the vote to originally divide the British Mandate of Palestine into two states, one Jewish and one Arab. The vote was 138 nations in favor, 9 opposed, and 41 abstentions. Of course, the 9 votes that were opposed were led by the United States and Israel, and there were a few very small countries that are client states of the United States that voted along with the U.S.-Israel bloc to oppose, but overwhelmingly.
Palau, for example, that kind of thing.
Palau, Micronesia, you know.
Canada. But,
And Canada, yeah. And but ultimately, the vast majority of nations in the world supported non-member observer status for Palestine. Hamas came out and said that yes, they supported the vote. However, they condemned Fatah for the leader of Fatah, Mohammed Abbas, mentioning the state of Israel in his speech, since Hamas does not recognize the state of Israel. But also the leader of Hamas this week, Khaled Mashal, called for new PLO elections in which he said Hamas would take part. Now, this is not bending by Hamas to come closer to the Fatah position and unite with Fatah. It's really, I think, an effort to bring all of the groups in Palestinian politics together under one banner, and the PLO, and to perhaps radicalize the PLO.
Yeah, remember the last time the Palestinians did have a vote, Hamas won it, and that's what led to the split, is the United States and Israel.
2006.
The United States and Israel backed Fatah, resisting the results of that election.
Yeah. And so I think that would probably happen again. I think if there was another vote, Hamas would probably win, and that's why the leader of Hamas is proposing a new vote. Of course, with another Hamas win, the West would not, I think, back the new Hamas government.
And by the way, the tactic of proposing and honoring votes only when they agree with your interests, Hamas is doing that. But oddly enough, the U.S. and Israel have a long track record of doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
All right. Egypt.
Yeah, this week Egypt's Constitutional Assembly voted yesterday, to approve a new constitution for the country. But the vote came only after most of the secular members of the Constitutional Assembly actually got up and walked out. They were protesting some problems, some very major problems with the new constitution. Those problems include a lack of protections for individual rights, particularly the rights of women and the rights of religious minorities. Some problematic language that could institutionalize conservative Islamic law. Also, language giving too much power to the military to oversee its own budget and its own operations, which would not be, particularly its budget, would not be overseen by Parliament like the U.S. Congress oversees the U.S. military budget. Language in the Egyptian Constitution would also allow the military to try civilians in military courts whenever they please. The elections at the local level specified in the Constitution would allow local councils to be elected, but it would still keep all of the powers of local government in the hands of governors appointed by the federal government. And of course, the new Constitution contains no new provisions to combat corruption, corruption being a major feature of the Mubarak government recently overthrown.
This sounds an awful lot like what Mubarak had, doesn't it?
Yes, and you know, that's true, because for the sake of expediency, the Assembly, instead of starting from scratch and writing a whole new constitution, they just took the old constitution and made some minor changes to it. And that is turning out to be a problem. And the reason that they did this for the sake of expediency is because they had pressure from Morsi, the current president, because he wanted to hurry them along in their job. That's because Morsi now is literally the dictator of Egypt, after last week having made a decree where he banned the courts from making any rulings on any of his actions or any of his own rulings. And he earlier had dissolved parliament. Now there's really no legislative body of the government, and there's no judicial body that can oversee the federal government. So essentially, Morsi is a dictator on the level of Mubarak. And that has brought a lot of people out into the streets, literally hundreds of thousands of people protesting in Egypt, in Egypt's various cities.
And some interesting coalitions, too.
And some very interesting groups uniting in Egypt that hadn't been united before against Morsi and against the Muslim Brotherhood, which and that is Morsi's party. So he's trying to push through this new constitution as quickly as possible. He's trying to get it to vote by the Egyptian populace. And hopefully, once that new constitution is approved, he is hoping that new elections can be held, that the Muslim Brotherhood can dominate once again. And we'll just have to see whether or not the public really supports the new constitution, since it's looking very, very much like the old one.
All right.
Meet the new boss, etc.
Yes.
And finally, Syria.
Yes. There's going to be a very big vote in NATO next week. And what they're voting on is whether or not to deploy Patriot missiles along the border in Turkey. Now, the reason for those Patriot missiles to be deployed along the border in Turkey would be ostensibly for Turkey to have some protection against artillery and other bombs falling from Syria across the border on Turkish soil. However, the real reason for the Patriot missiles to be deployed along the southern border of Turkey with Syria would be to deny the ability of the Syrian government to fly airplanes in northern Syria. That's pretty much the expressed reason for this vote. In other words, they want to try to impose a northern no-fly zone in Syria. That's sounding to me an awful lot like the no-fly zone that was imposed in Iraq prior to the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
Except in this case also because the armed Syria opposition, which of course the United States both directly and indirectly is helping to arm, is heavily concentrated in that part of the country, at least the armed version of it, both on the Syrian side and the Turkish side of the border. What they're also trying to do is help the opposition create some sort of a land base. And that, of course, is a direct prescription for civil war.
Yeah, and the Obama administration is arguing, insiders in the Obama administration are arguing over whether or not the U.S. should now, post-election, finally step forward and arm the Syrian rebels more directly with heavy weaponry instead of just light weapons. I find that interesting now that Hillary Clinton is leaving as Secretary of State, that she's kind of washing her hands of this, that that the Obama administration, now that they don't have to worry about an election in 4 years or an election this year, can now come forward and do what they've been wanting to do all along.
All right. Events.
Number of events going on in the coming week. There, of course, people may have been tracking, been a number of large protests in Russia over the past several months, and quite a bit of repression of Russian activists as well in conjunction with that. There's going to be a solidarity picket with activists in Russia that'll be happening at the Russian consulate in Seattle today from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. That's in Madison Park at 3726 East Madison Street. Saturday today also, 1 p.m., there will be a rally. No to the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal. That's going to be happening up at the Peace Arch in Blaine, so folks from Seattle and Bellingham and Vancouver will all be coming together. That at 1 o'clock today. Monday night, December 3rd, the Pride Foundation will be hosting a panel on Marriage Equality Explained. That will be free at Town Hall, 8th and Seneca, downtown Seattle. Tuesday, December 4th, from 6 to 9 o'clock, Selma James will be presenting on Sex, Race, and Class on the University of Washington main campus. Campus, Gowen Hall, room 201. And Thursday, December 6th, is 30 days after the general election, and therefore the initiatives that passed in the election will be certified, and the elections that initiatives that passed during the election in Washington State will become law, and therefore it is Legalization Day, and there will be a Legalization Day rally at 7 p.m. at the Seattle Center Fountain celebrating marriage equality and the legal ability of same-sex couples to marry, and also legalization of marijuana, so there will be a stash mob at that event, BYOW. Thursday, December 6th, also from 7 to 8:30, Harriet Walden of Mothers for Police Accountability will be giving a presentation on the DOJ City of Seattle SPD consent decree and the process of creating that and some of the backstory behind that and what the city did and why the city did what it did. That will be at the University Congregational Church in the U District at 4515 16th Avenue Northwest. It's 16th right off the north side of 45th. Literally across the street from the north side of the UW campus. And then on Friday, December 7th, a week from yesterday, from 7:30 to 9 o'clock, Bishop Gene Robinson, the first gay ordained bishop in the world, I believe, will be doing Straight Talk on Gay Marriage. That'll be a $5 ticket. That also will be at Town Hall, 8th and Seneca in downtown Seattle.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.
And you can find more of my material at mariatomczyk.com.